Matt had supper as usual that evening with Maureen and her uncle in the hotel dining room. He didn't say anything about Virginia Barry approaching him earlier. That might have upset Maureen when there was no good reason for it. After the meal, Matt said his goodnights and headed upstairs. As he approached the door of his room, a warning instinct stirred inside him. He looked closely at the door, lowering his gaze to a spot a few inches above the floor. Whenever he stayed in a hotel, he put a small broken piece of a match between the door and the jamb when he left the room. It was unlikely anybody would notice the match, and if someone other than him opened the door, the stick dropped to the floor and warned him somebody had been in his room and might still be in there. The match was where it was supposed to be. Nobody waited inside to ambush him. Then why were those alarm bells going off in his brain? Matt sniffed the air, thinking that he might catch a whiff of tobacco smoke or other telltale odor drifting under the door. There was no balcony outside the single window in his room, but somebody could have gotten in that way. It would be difficult, but not impossible. He didn't smell anything unusual.
You're getting touchy in your old age.
Despite that, he used his left hand to unlock the door and open it, keeping his right hand on the butt of the .44. Light from the hallway spilled into the room.
What's that?
Matt stiffened as he saw a folded piece of paper lying on the floor. He stepped inside, leaving the paper where it was for the moment, and lit the lamp on the bedside table before he closed the door. He took a look around just to make sure the place was empty. Seeing he was the only one there, he picked up the sealed note and sat down on the edge of the bed. As he broke the seal and unfolded the paper, he smelled a faint scent of perfume.
It must be Virginia.
He thumbed his hat to the back of his head and started reading the words written in a precise hand with a definite feminine slant.
Matt, I'm sincerely sorry for that scene earlier. I don't know what got into me. I'm very frightened, but not that Cyrus won't come back. I'm afraid he will come back, because I know what he has planned, and it's terrible. He's going to recruit enough gunmen to wipe out the Indians once and for all. Before he left, I told him I wouldn't have any part of it, and he threatened me. Please, Matt, if you'll promise to protect me, I'll tell the sheriff and the judge everything. I know some of the other things Cyrus and that brute Tally have done. Please come to the Sierra House, and I'll tell you everything. Come tonight, and bring this letter with you, because I don't want it falling into the hands of any of Cyrus's spies. You didn't know he has spies here in town, did you? I'll tell you who they are, and everything else, if you'll just come to see me as soon as you get this. I'm begging you. Virginia.
Matt stared at the note for several more seconds, then shook his head. Did she really expect him to believe any of that hogwash? It was a trap, pure and simple, and Virginia was the bait. Tally probably slipped back into town to wait in Longacre's suite at the Sierra House for Matt to show up. Virginia would let him in, and then Tally would step up behind him, gun or knife in hand. But what if it wasn't a trap? What Virginia had written about Longacre coming back with enough gunmen to wipe out the Paiutes sounded like it could be true. Would Sheriff Sanger believe that if he heard it from Virginia? And even if he did, what could the sheriff do against a small army of gunslingers? He could deputize all the able-bodied men in town, himself included. Such a posse could give Longacre a lot hotter reception than he was expecting. Maybe it was worth talking to Virginia, just to be sure. But he wasn't going to forget his hunch about a trap. He wasn't going to just waltz in blindly. He folded the paper and stuck it in his shirt pocket. The notion that Longacre had people in town who were working secretly for him was an intriguing one. Matt wanted to find out if that was true. After putting the match back between the door and jamb, he went downstairs, luckily not encountering Ferguson or Maureen on the way. He didn't want to have to explain to him why he was going back out after he had told him he was turning in. Some people were still out and about, but Halltown was settling down for the night. Matt walked to the Sierra House and entered the hotel with a nod to the sleepy clerk behind the desk. The second floor corridor was deserted. His hand rested lightly on the butt of his .44 as he walked toward the big door at the end of the hall. When he got there, he used his left hand to knock.
Virginia, it's Matt Jensen.
It was gonna be mighty awkward if Longacre had shown up again. Virginia might not have expected that. No one came to the door. Matt leaned closer and listened, but he didn't hear a sound from inside the suite. He knocked harder, thinking that Virginia might be in one of the other rooms.
Can't be an ambush if no one lets me in.
Maybe he'd been wrong about it being a trap. He was about to knock again when he paused. Matt smelled something that made the hair on the back of his neck stand up. It was a coppery tang he had smelled many times before. As soon as he realized what it was, he reached down with his left hand, grasped the doorknob, and twisted. The knob turned. He threw the door open and stepped into the room with the Colt in his right hand. The odor thickened and made his stomach clench in horror. His gaze dropped to the floor, and he saw Virginia Barry lying there on the thick rug without a stitch of clothing on. But there was nothing erotic about the sight. A dark red puddle was soaking into the rug around her head, and blood still welled slowly from the gaping wound in her throat, adding to the puddle.
No.
Mac took an instinctive step toward her, even though he knew it was too late to help her. Her blue eyes were wide open, staring lifelessly at him, and they seemed to draw him on. At the same time, his brain screamed a warning, and he started to twist around. Too late. What felt like the whole world fell on his head, crashing down with stunning force. He had no chance to resist the man mountain named Judd Talley. The pain seeping into Matt's brain told him he was still alive, and that was better than the alternative, though not by much. It felt like a bunch of lunatic blacksmiths had set up a giant forge inside his skull, pounding out enough horseshoes for the whole blasted U.S. cavalry. Something hard prodded his shoulder, setting off a fresh clamor of agony in his head.
Wake up, Jensen.
Matt pried his eyes open and found himself staring down the twin barrels of a shotgun held by Sheriff Walt Sanger.
Don't you try nothing. Right now I'd like nothing better than to blow your head off, mister. Anybody who'd do something like that to a woman deserves whatever happens to him.
Despite the pain in Matt's head, his brain was functioning well enough for him to realize what was going on. He tried to speak, but his lips and tongue were so dry that they barely worked.
Sheriff, I didn't...
Don't waste your time lying, boy.
Sanger glanced at somebody Matt couldn't see.
Get him on his feet.
A couple of men stepped up, grasped Matt's arms, and hauled him upright. The room spun crazily around him for a moment, as if the world had started turning the wrong way. When it settled down and he could see straight again, he saw that he was still in the sitting room of Cyrus Longacre's suite in the Sierra House. Virginia Barry's body still lay there a few feet away. The puddle of blood had soaked into the rug and darkened until it was almost black. The men continued to hold on to Matt's arms, gripping him painfully tight so he couldn't get away. He recognized them as hombres he'd seen around town. They glared at him with loathing and seemed to be making an effort not to look at the grisly sight on the floor.
Sheriff, I didn't do this. Miss Barry was dead when I got here.
Sanger stepped closer and poked Matt hard in the belly with the shotgun.
Damn you, I said not to lie about it. I see it with my own eyes. That's your knife on the floor beside her, ain't it?
With his spirit sinking, Matt looked down and saw his Bowie laying just outside the puddle of blood. The broad, heavy blade lay smeared with crimson.
Yes, but whoever knocked me out took my knife and wiped Miss Barry's blood on it.
Oh, yeah, that's a likely story.
That's the truth. Think about it. You came in here and found me lying unconscious on the floor, right?
Yeah, right next to that poor dead woman. You know good and well that's what I found, Jensen.
Well, then what do you think happened? You really believe I cut her throat and then knocked myself out?
No, I think she tried to fight back when you came at her with that knife. She grabbed that pitcher off the table and busted it over your head, probably with her dying breath.
Matt's gaze shifted. He saw the broken shards of a heavy ceramic pitcher lying scattered on the floor at Virginia's feet.
That pitcher wasn't broken when I came in. Whoever knocked me out broke it to make it look like Virginia hit me with it. Can't you see that, Sheriff?
All I see is a no-good lying polecat who killed a young woman. Maybe she wasn't quite what you'd call a respectable woman, but that don't matter.
For the first time, Matt agreed with something Sanger said. No matter what Virginia had been, she didn't deserve her gruesome fate.
Someone's trying to make it look like I killed her, Sheriff, but I swear I didn't.
He knew who was behind it. Judd Talley knocked him out, and Talley was probably the one who killed Virginia on Cyrus Longacre's orders. It was hard to believe Longacre could be so ruthless as to have his own mistress murdered just to frame Matt.
Take him over to the jail, fellas. I'm putting this Lobo behind bars where he belongs.
Wait a minute, Sheriff. Why'd you come up here?
What do you mean, why did I come up here?
You didn't just wander down the hall and find us.
Well, of course not. The clerk downstairs come running into my office and said somebody was screaming up here. Said it sounded like a woman being killed. That was right after you came up here. Turn out, he was right.
He was lying. Like I told you, Virginia Barry was dead when I got here. She couldn't have screamed.
I got your say-so for that, nothing else. And I don't believe a word that comes out of your mouth, mister.
Why not?
Matt knew he ought to keep his anger under control, but he couldn't.
Because you're scared of Judd Talley? Or because Cyrus Longacre paid you off? Or is it both of those things, Sheriff?
The shotgun shook a little in Sanger's hands. The men holding on to Matt looked nervous. They knew at that range, if Sanger pulled the triggers, the double load of buckshot would cut them down too. After a moment, Sanger lowered the greener. Holding it at his side in his left hand, he used his right to draw the revolver on his hip. He pointed the gun at Matt.
Take him to jail, and if you want to make a break for it, Jensen, you go right ahead. I plumb enjoy putting a bullet in your brain.
As a matter of fact, Matt had already thought about trying to get away. He knew he could break loose from the grip of the two men holding him, but he didn't want to be considered a fugitive. If he escaped, it would be the same thing as admitting he was guilty. Then every lawman in the West would be against him. As much as it went against the grain for him, it might be best to put his faith in the legal system and prove his innocence. Obviously, the hotel clerk was lying about what had happened. But if there was some way to make him tell the truth...
I want a lawyer.
Huh. You'll get one. Yeah, you'll get one, sure enough.
It was morning before Matt found out why Sanger had found that so amusing. They marched him to jail with Sanger's gun in his back, showed him into a cell, and slammed the door with an iron clang that rang of finality in Matt's ears. Sanger refused to send word to Colin Ferguson about the arrest. Ferguson and Maureen were Matt's only real friends in Hall Town, and he knew they would try to help him. They would see to it he got a lawyer. When morning came, the door between the cell block and the sheriff's office opened, and Sanger came in with a grin on his walrus face.
Your lawyer's here, Jensen.
Matt had been stretched out on the uncomfortable bunk. He raised his sore head, sat up, and got to his feet. Sanger beckoned through the open door to someone in the office.
In here, Roscoe.
Matt remembered the name. Ferguson and Maureen had both talked about Roscoe Goldsmith, the attorney who tried to help the Paiute stand up to Cyrus Longacre. The short, stocky figure who came shuffling into the cell block did not appear very heroic. In fact, despite the early hour, he was unsteady enough on his feet that he looked like he was on the verge of falling down as he lunged for the cell bars. Sanger pointed into Matt's cell.
There's your client right there. That's the dirty murderer.
Goldsmith blinked bleary, red-rimmed eyes at Matt.
Doesn't look like a mad dog.
Reckon I ought to leave you two alone to talk. That'd be the legal way of doing things.
Goldsmith made a visible effort to pull himself together. He gripped the bars and straightened up, planting his thick legs far enough apart to brace himself. He was in his 50s, Matt guessed, although drinking often made a man look older than he really was. His face was broad and flushed. His hair, under a tipped-back derby, shone brown and thinning. His tweed suit looked like it had been slept in every night for a week. The odor of rot-gut whiskey came off him in waves, mixed with the reek of unwashed flesh.
My name is Roscoe Goldsmith. I'm going to be your attorney, young man.
I didn't hire you.
Maybe not, but if you want a lawyer, you're sort of stuck with me.
Matt kept a tight rein on his temper, but it wasn't easy.
You're drunk as a skunk.
Having never seen an inebriated polecat, I assure you, young man, I am drunker than a skunk.
Goldsmith waved an arm, swayed as that gesture threw him off balance, and grabbed the bars again to steady himself.
But drunk or sober, I am also the only honest lawyer in Helltown.
Something glittered in his eyes as he said that, a fleeting flash of anger, and Matt wondered how much of it was directed at Cyrus Longacre and his henchmen, and how much was turned inward at the sort of man Goldsmith had become versus the sort of man he might have been.
Listen to me. I didn't kill that girl.
It doesn't matter. My job is to give you the best possible defense.
It matters to me. This is all Cyrus Longacre's doing. He wants to get me out of the way, but he's using the law to do it for him. His cronies back in Washington are probably pressuring him to make things appear to be legal, whether they really are or not.
That's what those people in Washington do, all right? Biggest bunch of thieves and gutter snaps.
Get Colin Ferguson and bring him over here to see me. Can you do that?
Colin's a good man. Good friend.
Get him. We've got to start figuring out some sort of strategy for the trial.
Better hurry then. Trial's this afternoon.
This afternoon?
Judge Dunwoody says don't need to wait. Every man is entitled to speedy trial. Law says so.
Get Ferguson now.
Goldsmith drew himself up.
See here, young man. I'm the attorney, not you. I... Sheriff!
Matt stepped to the cell single window where the air was a little fresher. Sanger came in and saw what had happened.
Oh, son of a... I ain't cleaning that up, Roscoe.
Goldsmith stood bent over with his hands braced on his knees. After a moment, he was able to straighten up. He turned toward the cell, wiped the back of a hand across his mouth.
I'll get Colin.
Then he stumbled out.
I ain't cleaning that up.
Roscoe's really a smart man and a good lawyer when he hasn't had too much to drink.
Colin Ferguson conferred with Matt through the barred door a short time later.
It's just that once every week, or 10 days, almost like clockwork, he goes on a bender. It's been that way ever since his wife died. Poor fellow's never gotten over it.
I might feel sorry for him if I wasn't behind bars.
Tell me what happened. Now, go through the whole thing.
Matt explained everything he knew about Virginia's death.
What I can't figure out is why anybody would think I even had a reason to kill her.
Well, that's easy enough. There's lots of talk around town about it this morning. Everybody thinks you and the girl were, romantically involved. People have seen you talking to her on several occasions, and there were witnesses to the fight you had with her last night.
What fight? When she slapped me on the boardwalk in front of the Milner shop?
That would be the one.
It didn't make any sense to me at the time, but it does now. She had orders to make it look like we were fighting.
Wait a minute. She helped set up the motive for her own murder?
I don't know what she thought the plan was, but Longacre, or more likely Tally carrying out Longacre's orders, told her what to do. She couldn't have had any idea the whole thing would wind up with her getting her throat cut.
Well, it appears they've got the whole thing sewn up quite neatly. They've got a motive, far-fetched though it may be. It is far-fetched, isn't it? You weren't dallying with that girl.
I give you my word, Colin, there was nothing between me and Virginia Barry.
All right then, I believe you. But they have motive, they have the clerk's testimony that he heard the woman scream, and they have the sheriff finding you there with her body and her blood on your knife. Even an honest, unbiased jury might have a hard time returning a verdict of not guilty, lad.
It's unlikely there'll be an honest, unbiased jury.
You speak more truth than you know. Judge Tally and more than a dozen gunmen rode in this morning. The whole town's scared. Tally acted surprised when he heard what had happened to the Barry woman, and he and his friends are going around saying that if justice isn't done, the town will pay the price.
Why don't they just go ahead and start building the gallows?
Well,
they are, aren't they?
They're getting the wood together. Everybody's expecting that the trial won't take long. They think there'll be a verdict by the end of the day.
And a hanging tomorrow.
And that was the way it was. The trial was a joke, with Longacre's tame judge overruling every objection and denying every motion Roscoe Goldsmith made. The only defense Goldsmith could mount was to put Matt on the stand to tell his story. Matt told the truth, laying Virginia Barry's killing at the feet of Judd Tally, who sat in the front row of spectators with a confident smirk on his face. The nervous-looking jury hadn't even withdrawn to consider their verdict. They talked among themselves for a few moments, then one of them stood up and announced the guilty verdict. Judge Dunwoody quickly announced a death-by-hanging penalty, and he adjourned the proceedings over the feeble objections of Roscoe Goldsmith. So there was nothing left but to wait for the gallows to be finished. Matt sat on the bunk in his cell, still aching from the head-banging Tally gave him, thinking he should have made a break for it when he had the chance, law or no law. He expected to be railroaded, but he hadn't known his enemies would do such a swift, efficient job of it.
Well, they can think they got me licked, but they're not going to hang me.
He would get his hands on a gun somehow. And even though he would wind up riddled with slugs, before he went down, he would get led into Judd Tally. Count on it.
Anyway, smoking preacher will show up in time.
The minutes kept slipping away. But they would be there, sooner or later. And when they found out what happened to him, all hell would break loose. Cyrus Longacre was going to be mighty sorry he ever tangled with a Jensen. That thought brought a bleak smile to Matt's swollen lips as he waited for someone to come and get him and march him to the gallows. Or try to, anyway. Big Rock, Colorado. Smoke Jensen looked up at his friend and grinned.
Be careful there, Monty. We don't want you to fall and break your neck.
I'm not going to fall and break my neck.
Sheriff Monty Carson replied from the top of the ladder.
And if I do, it's going to be your fault, you dang chucklehead.
Monty Carson could get away with talking to Smoke like that because they were old compadres, men who had ridden the river together. Most hombres, though, would be a mite leery of insulting a man widely considered to be one of the fastest and deadliest gunfighters to ever ride the frontier. Now, Smoke hadn't set out to acquire that reputation, but he had never run from trouble. He was what he was and never saw any point in denying it. Fortunately, the gunman was just part of the man who had been born Kirby Jensen. He was also the loving, devoted husband to Sally, the successful rancher who owned the spread called Sugarloaf, the boss to loyal hands like his foreman Pearly and young Calvin Woods, and the good friend to the citizens of Big Rock, such as Sheriff Carson and gambler Lewis Longmont, who owned one of the local saloons. Smoke was all those things and more. Right then, he was the fella holding the ladder while Monty Carson repaired the jail's roof. Holding a hammer instead of a six gun, the sheriff leaned far to one side.
I think I can reach one more before we have to move the ladder.
Monty, be careful. You're going to...
Whoa!
Carson lost his balance. He dropped the hammer and grabbed for the edge of the roof to steady himself. His frantic lunge came up short. Smoke reached up and tried to catch hold of the sheriff's belt, but Carson had already toppled out of reach. Monty Carson crashed to the ground in the alley beside the jail. Smoke heard the sharp cracking sound. Carson clutched at his right leg. Smoke knelt beside him, offering consolation.
Well, I was wrong. Said you were going to break your neck, and it's only your leg you broke.
Eyes wide with pain, Carson looked up at his friend.
I'll get you for that, Smoke. You better fetch the doctor.
That's what I was thinking.
Smoke gave his friend a reassuring squeeze on the shoulder, then hurried to the mouth of the alley.
Pearly!
The Sugarloaf foreman turned from loading the supply wagon to look at Smoke.
Go find Doc Simpson. Sheriff Carson's hurt.
Dr. Hiram Simpson knelt next to Carson, set his black bag down, and opened it. He cut away the leg of Carson's trousers to expose the injury. Smoke winced as he saw the unnatural way the leg was bent and the ugly lump under the skin where the broken bone pressed against it.
Well, at least the bone's not sticking out. We should be grateful for small favors, eh, Sheriff?
You can be grateful if you want! I don't plan on being too happy about any of this!
You'll make a quicker recovery this way. I'll get the bone stabilized and splinted, and then we can take it down to my surgery and put a cast on that leg.
A cast? That means I'll be laid up for a while.
That's usually what happens when you break your leg.
Doc looked up at Smoke, Pearly, and Cal.
I'll need a couple of 2x4s for splints, probably about a foot and a half long.
We'll go see what we can find.
Oh!
Hurting pretty bad, Monty.
Of course it hurts! But I'm worried. I got a couple of deputies who can handle the usual problems. But if there's any real trouble, Big Rock's gonna need a real sheriff.
Carson gave Smoke an intent look. Smoke lifted both hands.
Hold on, Monty.
You've worn a star before.
Not that often, and I was never all that comfortable with it. Have you forgotten I was a wanted man myself for a while?
You were never a real outlaw, and you know it. The charges against you were trumped up.
Now, plus, I've got a ranch to run.
And a fine crew to run it.
Carson winced as Dr. Simpson moved his leg slightly.
Lord, Doc, if you're gonna twist it like that, why don't you just go ahead and saw it off?
Settle down. I'll give you some laudanum before I actually set the leg.
Carson turned his head to look at Smoke again.
What about it, Smoke? Just take over for a while until I get back on my feet. Shouldn't be more than a week, should it, Doc?
6 weeks. Maybe longer. You won't be back to full strength for several months.
Smoke hunkered on his heels next to Carson and thumbed his hat back on his close-cropped ash-blonde hair.
Tell you what I'll do, Monty. I'll send a telegram to the governor and ask him to see about getting a real lawman down here to take over for a while. Maybe a deputy U.S. Marshal or somebody like that. And that shouldn't take very long, maybe a week or so. I'll keep an eye on things until then. Deal?
Deal!
Even though he was in great pain, Carson raised his hand and shook with Smoke.
Well, I feel better already knowing somebody's going to be watching over the town. Well, I can't.
The men from Sugarloaf came out of the doctor's house a short time later and paused on the porch. With a sly smile, Pearly turned to Cal.
You know, Cal, when Doc saw it was me come running in, he figured I'd come fetch him because you'd been shot again.
I haven't been shot that many times.
Heck, you catch lead in just about every fracas that comes along. We've had to dig so many slugs out of you, you're practically a lead mine.
Well, you've been shot a time or two yourself, as I recall.
Yeah, but at least I got sense enough to duck when the bullets commenced to flying.
That's enough, you two.
Smoke knew those two would squabble happily for hours if nobody put a stop to it.
You can take those supplies we brought back out to the ranch and tell Sally I'll be staying in town for a while.
You're not coming back to Sugarloaf with us?
Smoke explained about the promise he'd made to Monte Carson.
I'll walk down to the train station and send a wire to the governor. Shouldn't take that long to get somebody down here to take over.
Until then, you're the law and Big Rock, huh?
Monty's deputies are the law. I'm just keeping an eye on things for the time being. I don't plan on pinning on the sheriff's badge unless there's some real trouble. The good Lord willing, there won't be.
The two men lounging at the bar in one of the town saloons were strangers to Big Rock. They rode in earlier in the day, took a good look around, especially at the bank, and then settled down to have a drink. They were big, hard-faced, beard-stubbled men, and the coating of trail dust on their clothes testified to the fact that they'd done some long, hard, fast traveling in recent weeks. One of the men tossed back the whiskey that remained in his glass and motioned for the bartender to refill it. His companion shook his head and put his hand over the empty glass. If the meaning of the gesture wasn't obvious enough to start with, he turned to the man.
You've had enough, Crandall.
The stocky Crandall scowled.
Blast it, Burke. You got no right to tell me how much I can drink.
You want to argue about who's got what right?
Crandall grimaced and shook his head.
No, don't get me wrong. I ain't looking for trouble.
We need to go.
Sure, whatever you say.
Burke led the way out of the saloon. Nobody paid any attention to him and Crandall as they untied their horses from the hitch rail, swung up into their saddles, and rode slowly out of town. They were just two more drifting cowpunchers, the sort of man who passed through Big Rock all the time looking for work on one of the ranches in the lush southern Colorado rangeland that surrounded the town. It would take a closer look for anybody to notice the cold, flint-like hardness of their eyes or the well-worn walnut grips on their revolvers.
So long, Big Rock. We'll be back.
I thought you said it would be too risky to hit the bank here, since the place has got a tough hombre like Monte Carson as its sheriff.
You weren't paying attention to the talk in the saloon, Crandall. I was. While you were pouring whiskey down your throat, somebody came in and said the Sheriff Carson fell off a ladder and broke his leg.
Really? I'll bet he's got deputies, though.
A couple. But from the sound of everything I heard, they're nothing for us to worry about. There won't be any match for us. We'll rendezvous with Stonebreaker and the rest of the boys, and then in a day or two, we'll pay Big Rock another visit.
And leave with all the money in the bank, eh?
And leave with all the money in the bank. And if those deputies or anybody else try to stop us, it'll be their funeral.
When she heard the creaking of wagon wheels drifting through the open window, Sally Jensen looked up from the plate of donuts she had just taken out of the hot grease and set them aside to cool. She turned to the window and moved the curtain aside, expecting to see her husband on the big Palouse horse he rode as he accompanied the wagon.
That's the best you can do with that wagon. That's why you left a drunk man's tracks.
Takes one to know one, doesn't it, Pearlie?
It does, it does.
Instead, she saw only Calvin Woods sitting on the wagon seat, hauling back on the reins to bring the team to a halt. Pearlie rode alongside on horseback. There was no sign of Smoke or the Palouse he rode into town. For a second, she felt a tinge of fear that something had happened to Smoke. Pearlie and Cal were grinning and laughing as they jibed at each other about something, and that wouldn't be the case at all if Smoke was hurt. Despite the fact that she was an educated, highly intelligent woman, most of the time she felt like there was nothing in the world that could hurt Smoke Jensen. Some folks would say he led a charmed life. Of course, that wasn't true at all. He'd been wounded many times, sometimes seriously. His heavily muscled, broad-shouldered body was covered with scars. What's more, Smoke suffered considerable tragedy in his life. His older brother Luke was killed during the Civil War. His father Emmett was cut down by gold-hungry outlaws. And his sister Janie had met a bad end as well. Smoke lost his first wife, Nicole, and their infant son, Arthur, to murder at the hands of owl hoots. You might say death dogged much of Smoke's life. In fact, Smoke was running from the law under the name of Buck West when Sally first met him. She had come from New Hampshire to teach in the Idaho town of Barry. Sally's life took a turn for the better the day she met Smoke, and she liked to think the same was true for him. They endured a lot together, fighting Indians, outlaws, and the elements to forge a life on Sugarloaf. She tended to his wounds when he got shot up. She killed men who needed killing. And even when things looked bleak, she never gave up. The two ranch hands came into the kitchen a moment later, each carrying a box of supplies.
I told Pearlie I smell bear sign.
You can eat your fill as soon as it cools off and you tell me where Smoke is.
Well, he's still in town. Sheriff Carson was trying to patch up some damage to the roof of his office from that big windstorm yesterday.
And?
Oh, he fell off the ladder. Didn't I tell you that part?
No. You mean Sheriff Carson fell off?
Yeah. Smoke warned him. Told him he was going to break his neck.
Oh, my goodness. Monty broke his neck?
No, ma'am. I never said that.
Well, he broke his leg. Busted it clean in two.
Oh.
Sally felt relieved, even though she hated to hear that Monty Carson was hurt.
Well, is he going to be all right?
Yeah, but Doc Simpson said he's going to be laid up for a good long while.
Sheriff Carson got Smoke to promise he'd sort of look after the town.
For how long?
Sally was used to Smoke being away from Sugarloaf for weeks or sometimes months at a time, but she didn't have to like it.
Well, Doc claims it'll be 6 weeks before the sheriff can even start getting up and around again. Could be several months before he's plumb back up to snuff.
Oh.
Sally perked up slightly. Big Rock wasn't far away. If Smoke couldn't come back to the ranch, maybe she'd go and stay in town with him, or at least visit frequently. No matter how competent Pearlie and Cal and the other hands were, someone would still need to keep an eye on what was happening at Sugarloaf.
Oh, but you don't have to worry. Smoke won't have to stay there the whole time. He was going to send a wire to Denver and ask the governor to send somebody down to take over for Sheriff Carson, you know, until the sheriff got back on his feet.
Sally smiled. That was even better. Smoke had done more than one favor for the governor in the past, so she knew the man would act quickly to handle the request. Smoke would probably be home in a few days, or a week at most.
How long you reckon it'll be before that bear sign's cooled off enough to eat?
It might be ready by the time you and Pearlie finish bringing in the supplies. Aren't you worried you'll ruin your appetite for supper?
Trust me, ma'am. That ain't never gonna happen.
The man standing off a ways from the campfire was big, but there was something more than sheer size that drew the eye to him. He had that magnetic quality that all great leaders have, a certain intangible aspect that made men want to follow him out of a mixture of respect, awe, and even a little fear. He might have been a military general, or a statesman, or a titan of industry. Of course, not all men who possessed that quality rose to such heights. Oliver Stonebreaker didn't lead an army, or a political party, or business. He led a motley gang of outlaws. His circumstances in life, a petty thief for a father and a whore for a mother, neither of whom had lived long enough to see young Oliver's 8th birthday, robbed him of his true destiny. So Oliver robbed too. He killed as well when anyone got in his way, and he raped when the mood struck him. His men knew to steer clear of him when one of his increasingly frequent rages fell upon him, but they never gave any thought to leaving him. He was smart. And since he had started running the gang and planning their jobs, they hadn't even come close to getting caught. They collected plenty of loot to divvy up, and whenever it started to run low, why, they just found themselves another bank to rob. Or rather, Stonebreaker did. He picked out the targets, and like the great general he might have been, he sent men to scout them and get the lay of the land before he acted. If a job looked like it would be too dangerous or not profitable enough, the Stonebreaker gang passed it by, waited for something better. That way, they stayed out of prison, and more important, stayed alive.
What's keeping those two?
Southern Colorado wasn't Stonebreaker's usual stomping grounds. He didn't know the name of the settlement or the bank he'd sent Burke and Crandall to check out. They weren't back yet, and he worried that they might have gotten into trouble. He wasn't particularly concerned about something bad happening to him, but if they ran afoul of the law, they might sell out the rest of the gang to save their own hides. Unfortunately, he couldn't really trust a bunch of cold-blooded bank-robbing murderers. Stonebreaker swung around toward the fire. He was an impressive figure in a black frock coat, with a gray-shot spade beard that stuck out from his massive jaw. He never wore a hat, so the night wind stirred the long, wild thatch of dark hair that hung to his shoulders. The only spots of lightness about him were the pearl-handled revolvers that rode butt forward in his holsters. He knew the guns were fancy, but he liked them. More important, he was good with them. Close to a dozen men sitting around the fire got to their feet as they heard the horses. Some of them picked up rifles leaning against the rocks near the fire. Others rested their hands on their holstered guns. The riders were probably their fellow outlaws Burke and Crandall, but men who rode the dark, lonesome trails knew it never paid to take chances.
Hello, the camp!
Stonebreaker strode forward.
Come on in, Burke.
The rest of the men relaxed. Burke and Crandall rode into camp and dismounted. A couple men took their horses to unsaddle them and picket them with the others. Another man handed them cups of coffee. Stonebreaker waited until the man swigged down some of the arbuckles, but he couldn't contain his impatience any longer.
Well, what'd you find out?
The bank looks pretty prosperous. Impressive building, brick, two stories.
Well, doesn't mean there's any money in the vault.
There ought to be. There are several big cattle spreads in the area, and it's getting on toward the end of the month. Be payday for the hands soon. The businesses in the settlement seem to be doing pretty well, too. The saloons alone probably make some big deposits. Throw in all the stores and the other businesses, and there'll be money in the vault, all right.
Yeah, sounds promising. Yeah, what about the law situation?
A grin spread across Burke's lean, sardonic face.
That's even better. The local sheriff fell off a ladder and busted his leg while we were in town. He's going to be laid up for a while, and that's a good thing, because he's Monte Carson.
Stonebreaker's bushy eyebrows drew down in a frown as he shook his head.
No, I don't recognize the name.
I never met him, but I've heard of him. He used to be a hired gun, years ago. Pretty tough hombre. I guess that life got to be too hard for him. He settled down and started packing a star instead. He's probably lost some of his edge, but I just assume not have to find out. With him laid up, all we have to worry about is a couple green deputies who won't be any real threat to us.
Stonebreaker suppressed the impulse to rub his hands together in anticipation.
Well, from the sound of it, we can not only empty the bank, but take over the rest of the town.
I think you're right, boss. We can pick the whole settlement clean if we want to. Might even be a good place to hold up for a little while.
Now I'll decide things like that.
Sure. Well, I never figured otherwise.
Stonebreaker nodded in satisfaction and started to turn away.
By the way, what's the name of this place?
You'll like this, boss, because of your name. It's called Big Rock. Big Rock. Stonebreaker? You get it?
Stonebreaker froze as his muscles stiffened and his breath caught in his throat. He stood like that for a moment, then slowly swung around.
What did you call it?
Big Rock. But I didn't mean nothing by it.
You never heard of Big Rock before?
Crandall shook his head and glanced at Burke.
No, I don't think so. Should I have?
Something rang a bell when you mentioned Monte Carson, but I wasn't paying attention. Now tell me, while you were there, did you see a man who stands maybe a couple inches over 6 feet with shoulders about as broad as an axe handle? He wears two guns, one holstered in the regular way, on the right, and then one on the left, butt forward. He has ash blonde hair, sort of the color of smoke.
Well, I don't recall seeing anybody like that.
Crandall shook his head again.
Who is he? An old enemy of yours?
No, not really. I saw him in action once over in Kansas. That's how I know what he looks like, but he wasn't gunning for me. He killed 4 men in less time than it takes to tell it.
Sounds like quite a gun slick.
You could say that. He smoked Jansen, you idiot!
A stunned silence hung over the camp after Stonebreaker's shout.
Well, yeah, smoked Jansen, I heard of him.
Of course you have. He has a ranch near Big Rock, Colorado. He's friends with Monte Carson, that old gunfighter turned lawman. If Carson's laid up, there's a good chance he's asked Jansen to help keep the peace in the town for a while.
We can't know that for sure. From what I've heard about Jensen, he roams around a lot. He might not even be in these parts right now.
Stonebreaker got control of his anger and nodded.
He might not be, but we have to find out before we decide what to do.
What are we gonna do if he is around? Just forget about the bank and turn tail and run?
Stonebreaker moved with blinding speed for such a big man. His arms shot out, swinging around like a freight train. The back of his hand cracked across Crandall's face with such force, the blow sent the stocky outlaw flying backward. Crandall lay on his back. He pushed himself up on his elbows and looked groggy. With one hand, he took hold of his jaw and worked it back and forth to see if it was broken.
No, we're not going to turn tail and run. We're not going to forget about that bank either. But we have to find out if Smoke Jensen is in Big Rock. And if he is, then we'll have to deal with him before we make our move.
How are we gonna do that?
Stonebreaker's lips curved in a vicious smile under the thick mustache that drooped over him.
It's called a trap.
The back room of the sheriff's office and jail held a cot where Monte Carson sometimes spent the night when he had reason to. Smoke stayed there now. In the morning, Carson's deputies arrived to find a bright-eyed Smoke Jensen at the sheriff's desk. Smoke knew both men, though not well. He had spoken to them briefly the evening before, telling them to go ahead with their normal routine and make their rounds as they usually did.
Morning, Smoke. Town seems pretty quiet.
That's what I thought. I'm hoping it stays that way. I'll be either here or somewhere around town if you need help, but you fellas are in charge. I figure you know more about how Monty would want things done than I do.
Thanks. I've got to admit, knowing we've got Smoke Jensen to call on if a bad ruckus breaks out makes me feel a mite better.
I plan on moving over to the hotel today. That way, whichever one of you normally works nights can get back on your regular schedule.
Smoke left the office and walked down the street to the livery stable where he had left his Palouse. Smoke chewed the fat with the elderly hostler for a while, then went over to the hotel and made arrangements for a room. As he was leaving the hotel, he spotted Pearly riding into Big Rock with a war bag tied to his saddle. Smoke lifted a hand in greeting.
The ranch is just fine. Miss Jensen was a mite surprised when she heard you weren't coming home for a while, but she didn't seem upset.
That's good.
Smoke nodded. Sally was a little more adaptable than some women. Unexpected developments seldom threw her, which was good, seeing as how sharing a life with him had never been what anybody would call predictable.
You missed out on some mighty good bear sign. Cal says it was some of the best he's ever eaten. And he sure stuffed his belly full to prove it. How are things here in town, Smoke? You need any help?
Quiet. Mighty quiet. Things keep up like this, the main thing I'll have to worry about is getting bored.
Oh, we wouldn't want that to happen. Maybe you'll get lucky and things will start to pop.
Yeah, lucky.
Oliver Stonebreaker was not a patient man. Prodigious appetites for food, drink, money, women, and power gripped him all his life. And that sort of drive didn't allow for patience. So part of him stood ready to attack Big Rock, to charge into the settlement with guns blazing as soon as darkness descended over the land. But another part of him harbored cunning enough to know he needed to wait. His four men in town needed to take out Jensen before the rest of the gang could take out the settlement.
You wouldn't think one man could make that much difference.
But Stonebreaker knew it was true. Smoke Jensen was perhaps the best pure fighting man anywhere on the frontier. Better even than Stonebreaker. And the outlaw chieftain knew how dangerous he was. Jensen was worth at least half a dozen good men in a battle. Still more important was Jensen's ability to rally others to his cause. The man was a natural leader. Stonebreaker once heard about how Jensen banded together with a group of cantankerous old mountain men more than once to wipe out small armies of outlaws. With Jensen leading the defense of Big Rock, the townspeople would find courage they didn't even know they had. Without Jensen, and without their tough old sheriff, any resistance they put up would quickly collapse. Stonebreaker was counting on that, and he was enough of a strategist to know it was true.
Where in the blazes are they?
But as the stars came out, then gave way to the rising moon, and the evening passed without any sign of his men, Stonebreaker began to worry. It was time for Burke, Crandall, Fisk, and the other one to be getting back, and they hadn't shown. Stonebreaker and the other eight members of the gang stood waiting in a thick stand of trees on top of a hill about a quarter mile from Big Rock. The shadows were so thick no one could see them. Stonebreaker set strict orders that none of the men were to light up a quirly or anything else. He didn't want them striking matches that might be noticed in town. Stonebreaker paced back and forth at the edge of the trees with his hands clasped behind his back. No plan was ever perfect. Some small detail always went wrong. Usually, it didn't have any effect on the outcome of things, but unaccustomed worry gnawed at Stonebreaker's brain now. He had a feeling something bigger than usual was wrong. One of the men came up behind him.
Boss, maybe we ought to get out of here.
Stonebreaker swung around.
Maybe you should let me do the thinking.
Stonebreaker stalked through the trees, weaving back and forth around the trunks with uncanny ease, though it was almost too dark for a man to see his own hand in front of his face. He glared at the town. A chorus of gibbering demons clamored inside Stonebreaker's head. He willed them to shut up.
The hell with it! We're taking that town! Jensen would have called an alarm by now if the boys hadn't taken him out.
He turned to his men.
Four of us will go to the bank. The rest of you spread out and keep the citizens occupied. Any valuables you can grab will be gravy.
We still ought to come out with a good haul.
Of course we will! In case Jensen's still alive and has any thoughts about following us, we'll make sure he's too busy for that. You put the torch to the town as you ride out. We'll burn Big Rock to the ground!
Fighting the boredom of another quiet night in Big Rock, Smoke sat at Monte Carson's desk in the sheriff's office, thumbing through Dodgers, catching up on the latest criminal activity. Some faces looked familiar, and nearly all showed the same bewhiskered, desperate gaze of the Owl Hoot. Smoke opened the desk drawer to put the pile back when he came across the picture of a man with eyes like glowing embers set in a face chiseled from stone. This fella was no simple outlaw. Nope, Smoke was looking at a leader of men. According to the Dodger, a leader of desperate men blazing a trail of robbery, murder, and destruction across the West. Oliver Stonebreaker.
Now there's a name for you.
The strands of a whispered argument through the open window broke his trance.
You could get another drink after we kill Jensen. Hell, Crandall, you could drink up the whole saloon.
Come on, Burke, just one more. It'll steady my nerves if this Jensen is all he's cracked up to be.
Stonebreaker will be cracking up you if you don't shut up and help me get rid of Jensen.
Smoke set down the Dodgers, quietly closed the drawer, and silently made his way to the back door. He came around the back corner of the building and saw four dark shapes huddled near the front.
You're sure Jensen's in there? It seems mighty quiet.
That's what the deputy told a bartender.
What if he's not? What if he's...
You boys looking for me?
Crandall, Burke, and the others clawed for iron. Stonebreaker kept a member of the gang named Lucas Martin with him. Martin was their blaster, a former miner, and an expert at handling dynamite. He'd be able to blow the door off the vault in the bank without wrecking the whole place. Two more men went with him to serve as guards while Stonebreaker and Martin took care of getting to the money. The rest of the gang spread out. They would enter Big Rock by ones and twos, getting into position to terrorize the townspeople, then waiting for Stonebreaker's signal to launch the attack. The four of them, Stonebreaker, Martin, Dave Ritter, and Amos Green, rode openly down Big Rock's main street toward the bank. The town was settling down for the night, but quite a few people were still out and about. Stonebreaker knew he was a striking figure, so he wasn't surprised when some of the locals stared at him. He didn't let that bother him. Unlike some outlaws, he never tried to conceal his identity. He took pride in his hard-earned reputation as a bad man. When they reached the bank, they dismounted. Martin took his saddlebags filled with dynamite from his horse and slung them over his shoulder. With Ritter and Green leading the way, they started down the dark alley beside the bank. Stonebreaker turned to follow his men into the shadows.
Hey, mister, wait a minute.
Stonebreaker stopped and looked to his right. A man hurried along the boardwalk toward him. As he passed a lighted window, the glow reflected off the badge pinned to his shirt, telling Stonebreaker it was one of the deputies. Martin and the others had paused. Stonebreaker waved him on as he turned to face the lawman.
What can I do for you?
The deputy came to a stop a few feet away, with his hand resting on the butt of his gun.
Well, I saw you fellas riding into town just now. No offense, but I like to keep track of strangers, especially when they come into Big Rock after dark.
You think we might be up to no good, is that it?
Well, like I said, no offense, but you hombres look like you still got plenty of bark left on you.
Indeed we do, deputy.
Hey, how'd you know I'm a deputy and not the sheriff?
Stonebreaker's arm shot out with blinding speed for such a big man. His right hand clamped around the deputy's neck to choke off an outcry, while his left grabbed hold of the man's wrist to keep him from drawing his gun. Jerking the deputy closer to him to get better leverage, Stonebreaker twisted hard on the unfortunate lawman's neck. The deputy went limp in his grasp. Stonebreaker slung the dead man into the alley like a sack of garbage and followed Martin and the other two outlaws. Green broke the lock, pushed the door open, and the four men went inside. Stonebreaker struck a match, cupping the flame in his hand so that it couldn't be seen easily through the front windows. It provided just enough light for them to find the vault. Martin worked quickly, taking a couple of sticks of dynamite from his saddlebags and attaching them with paste to the vault door hinges. He stuck another stick of dynamite to the lock mechanism the same way. It took him only moments to put caps and fuses on the explosives. After the blast, the doors ought to fall forward, allowing them into the big safe. The explosions would signal the rest of the gang to launch their raid. Stonebreaker slipped a pocket watch from his vest and opened it to check the time.
Burke and the others should be done by now.
He snapped the watch closed and looked at Martin.
So are we. Light 'em up, Oliver.
Light 'em up.
Martin struck a match openly and held the flame to each of the three fuses in turn, moving quickly.
Let's get out of here.
Martin and the rest headed toward the back door. They would wait in the alley while the vault door blew, then rush back in and start shoveling cash and gold coins into the sacks they had brought along to fill. Stonebreaker let the other three go ahead of him. He lingered for a second, watching in satisfaction as the fuses burned toward the dynamite. That part of the operation went smooth. Stonebreaker jerked his head up.
Jensen!
Smoke ran out to the front of the building, looked farther down the street, and frowned slightly as he noticed several horses hitched to the rail in front of the bank. The building stood dark. Nobody would be doing any business there at that time of night. Nobody but outlaws who wanted to clean out the vault.
Holy!
The door of the bank crashed open, kicked from inside. As smoke dashed to the steps of the building, a huge figure loomed up from inside, filling the doorway. Smoke saw the long hair, the beard, and he knew he was looking at Oliver Stonebreaker. He was nothing to laugh about, and the outlaw knew him too.
Jensen!
Stonebreaker opened fire with two guns. A couple of men charged toward Smoke from up the street and opened fire as he whirled toward them. Out in the open like that, no one was deadlier than Smoke Jensen. His guns blasted twice. Both men went down as Smoke's lead tore through them. Before Smoke could do anything else, something crashed into him from behind, knocking him off his feet. Arms like tree trunks went around him and closed with crushing force, pinning his arms to his sides and making his ribs creak. Breathing was out of the question. It was like being hugged by a grizzly, and he knew Stonebreaker had tackled him.
I'm gonna break you apart with my bare hands, Jensen. You ruined my plans. No man can do that and live.
Smoke hunched his shoulders and lowered his head, then brought it up and back with stunning force. His skull smacked into the middle of Stonebreaker's face, smashing the outlaw's nose. Stonebreaker, for just a second, loosened his grip on Smoke, giving him the chance to break free. He broke Stonebreaker's grip, quickly found his feet, and pivoted in time to see one of those huge arms swinging at him. He ducked under the blow, spun, and brought up his pistol with all the force he could muster. He clubbed the man in the back of his head with the butt of his gun. That staggered the big man, but it did not put him down. Stonebreaker bullied forward, ramming a shoulder into Smoke's chest, driving him backward. His guns were jolted out of his hands. Smoke was vaguely aware that a battle was raging in Big Rock. He heard guns thunder and caught glimpses of orange muzzle flashes that lit the night like lightning. Smoke clubbed his hands together, bent his body upward, and brought him down with savage force against the side of Stonebreaker's neck. The man's grip loosened, and Smoke jerked free. He rolled over and pushed himself to his feet. Just as Stonebreaker surged after him, Smoke swung a right and a left. Both blows landed solidly and rocked the outlaw, but he did not go down. Stonebreaker charged again. Smoke ducked low, grabbed the beast's groin, and crushed. Stonebreaker curled in agony, and his face smashed into Smoke's rising knee. Smoke straightened and turned his head to look around. Lewis Longmont stood there, as slim and elegant and deadly as ever, smoke curling from the barrel of the revolver he held.
Smoke!
Smoke looked around, dazed. The shooting had stopped. He saw bodies sprawled here and there. Men he recognized as citizens of Big Rock moved among them, holding rifles, pistols, and shotguns.
The rest of the gang.
Either dead or begging for mercy.
The gambler holstered his gun and extended a hand to Smoke.
Here, let me help you up.
Smoke clasped his friend's hand and let Longmont help him to his feet. As they looked down at Stonebreaker, the rise and fall of the giant's chest told them the boss outlaw still lived.
You reckon I can get some volunteers to drag him down to the jail?
I don't think that'll be a problem at all.